Hello, on this week's program we take a walk through Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II collection at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and speak with the exhibition's organizer, Innes Shoemaker. David Patrick Stearns profiles the very talented pianists who perform daily at Philadelphia's Reading Terminal Market. Jason Pfeiffer takes us to the Simeon Foundation Museum, home to a world-class collection of historic sports and race cars. And Susan Lewis looks at the history and evolution of the Free Library of Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
An exhibition currently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art explores the collection of one of Philadelphia's most avid and successful contemporary collectors of modern art. Charles K. Williams II is an esteemed archaeologist who has also, over the past 20 years, amassed a collection of 20th century paintings, drawings, and sculptures that is breathtaking in its scale and range. Artists whose works adorn great public collections also crowd the walls of Williams's Philadelphia apartment. Household names like Joseph Stella, Charles Demuth, Giorgio de Chirico, Grant Wood, George O'Keefe, John Singer Sargent, Thomas Hart Benton, and more. More than 100 works from this collection are featured in Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II collection, now at the Darnes Galleries of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The museum's senior curator of prints, drawings, and photographs, Innes Shoemaker, organized the show. Take us back to the first time you walked into his apartment, and it is an apartment that this is usually hung in, on very crowded walls.
Well, of course, when I first met him, it wasn't as crowded as it is now. But when you do walk in now, you just see not only paintings that are double hung or in a kind of blaze of color, but he installs it in a way, he reinstalls it all the time, he changes it all the time. And so I find that every time I go there, it's different.
There's something in common with a rather more famous eclectic collector from the early part of the 20th century, a certain Dr. Barnes. Did the way he approaches hanging his own works at home have any impact on how you approached hanging the show?
Only because the spaces were so entirely different, I would say, in general, no. Although the room where the Thomas Hart Benton contains many works that he has hanging in his dining room. But he has a long corridor that's full of pictures. They're all over the place.
What are the special challenges of curating from a private collection as distinct from, say, the museum's collections?
Well, I would say that it's not so much the organization of the exhibition as it is the installation of it, because I've been familiar with this collection in a domestic setting, and suddenly I have a bunch of galleries and I have an audience of the public who I want to make sense of it for, and so that was probably the biggest challenge.
And Dr. Williams' collection is hugely diverse.
Yes, yes indeed. And in fact, I decided from the get-go that I was going to have an open installation that had no beginning or end. In other words, you can start in any room you want. But I discovered as I was installing it that I was installing it some things in a stylistic way and other things in a thematic way. For example, putting landscapes or still lifes or a wall of music or that kind of thing.
Because, of course, Charles Williams hasn't collected in the same way that you would collect for a museum, but he has an incredible eye.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, this is a museum-quality collection, and that's why we're so thrilled that he is going to and has been giving it to the museum over a number of years. But this has been a collection that has been selected one by one by one.
In the process of him gathering this collection together, you've clearly known him for quite a long time. Does he ever come to you and ask for advice?
Well, that's what's been fun with all of this. In no way have I advised him, but he does call me up and say, hey, I'm looking at this, and we talk about it, and it's been fun because I've seen things that he decided not to buy just as much as I've seen things that he ended up acquiring.
And have you ever talked to him about his collecting philosophy? Is there one? Is there, or is it just, I like it, I want it?
Oh, no. He's very thoughtful about how this collection is forming. And in fact, he's written a nice little statement in the catalog. But what he, one of the things that he does is he's a collector who, he's also a scholar. He, as the collection has grown, he begins to wonder whether he ought to find things that make some sort of different statement from what he has been doing, because he doesn't want his collection to get a look. And yet, when he sees something that he likes, he goes for it, whether or not, as he said, it fits tidily into his collection.
What would you like visitors to take away from this show? Clearly, it's a representation of one man's vision, one man's eye. What do you think visitors will take from it?
Well, I hope they think of this as being one man's eye, and how incredibly strong all of these images turn out to be when they're actually spread out in a way that people can take them in. But I think everybody will find favorites in a collection like this.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art senior curator of prints, drawings, and photographs, Ines Shoemaker. She organized Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II Collection, an exhibition which runs through September 13th at the museum's Dorrance Galleries.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Many places can claim to be Philadelphia's musical crossroads. Kimmel Center, the Academy of Music, the Mann Center. But here's one that's as consistently crowded as any, but easily overlooked. The piano at Reading Terminal Market, where a revolving roster of 20 or so musicians play for tips all day, every day. Gospel music, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chopin, and show tunes are heard at the north end of the market, bordered by lobsters and crabs on one side and exotic candles on the other. Tables and chairs surround the piano, where listeners can eat lunch or simply relax. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns has spent the summer popping in and out, listening and talking to these musicians, and discovering who they are.
Usually, hearing Chopin is a journey that starts at some box office, continues at the dry cleaners to press your good suit, and ends in some lofty, ornate concert hall. One slushy March day, I was hunting for lunch at the Reading Terminal Market and also got the kind of Chopin that could only come from a cultured musician. This summer, I finally found out her name. Galina Kalpin, born in Russia, lived in Estonia, moved to New York in 1991, and after her husband died, came to Philadelphia where her retirement dollars went further. Working as a home health aide for senior citizens, she almost forgot about the piano. Playing at the Reading Terminal has been her renaissance. Many other stories unfold behind this piano. There's Al Lauer, a Philadelphian who remembers the favorite songs of passersby and plays them as they're passing by, flanked by a mechanical monkey he found at a flea market and dressed up in sunglasses. The young star of the terminal is Mateo Jimenez, a jazz pianist who started out here as a kid and obviously has a bright future. The newest addition is Claudette Beswick from Jamaica, who recently retired from the physical therapy profession. She hasn't had a lesson in her entire life.
I barely know the keys I'm playing, but whatever, whatever I hear, my finger does the talking.
Really? That's great.
The talking, in her case, comes in the form of gospel and hymns.
But I jazz it up with my own tropical rhythm. I gave it that tropical Jamaican feel.
Good.
Yeah. Kind of bounce off on you.
Yeah,
I bounce on you.
That's right.
Kind of bounce on you. You hear it and you want to, you know. I saw people walking and sometimes they kind of walk to the music.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, because of the rhythm. Yeah.
So obviously the money isn't great.
No, the money's not great. I do this for the love of it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you love about it?
I tell you, I love when I play and I see when folks pass and they nod. And I like I said, when they walk to the music, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And those who are kind enough to give me a tip, I appreciate it and I love it. Yeah. And I wish I could do better than I am. But because, I told you, but because I love the music, I don't worry so much about the money.
Yeah.
I like doing it.
Tips at the terminal are appreciated but undependable, anywhere from $2 to $20 for a two-hour slot, and some players opt not to accept them. That's one thing that separates these pianists from street performers. Also, street performers, by their very nature of being on the street, are an accidental passing experience. At the terminal, there's a place to sit down and listen for a while. If you like what you hear, you can come back next week. That way, pianists such as 81-year-old retired accountant Ken Arts acquire fans and sidekicks. In fact, Ken has been befriended by a serious Sinatra freak and rather good singer he knows only as Ted.
In the morning mist, two lovers kissed and the world stood still. And your fingers touched my silent heart and taught it how to sing. Yes, true love's the many splendor thing.
Nobody at Reading Terminal is quite sure when this piano thing started. In some cases, the terminal management doesn't even know the last names of the pianists. There's really no need to, says General Manager Paul Steinke.
I've been here for 7.5 years, and there was a piano here when I got here. So I assume it has gone on far longer than that. Most of them, I think, wander in. It's word of mouth. Musicians around town know that we have a piano that can be played at will, you know, as long as there's a slot and as long as they're pretty good, in our relatively uneducated opinion.
It's you that I'll be.
Okay, it's not as quiet as the Kimmel Center.
And all the dreams I dream, beg or borrow, on some bright tomorrow, they'll all come true.
For all the drawbacks of the market, there are listeners who wouldn't be without it. Gabre has a fan, a retired Atlantic City security guard who pops in whenever she's in town. Another pianist, the ebullient Sophia Shilito, is beloved by Ed and Sherry Epstein, who drive in from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to hear her play. Sophia, in particular, has sincerity to burn. You can tell when she's playing something she really loves because the tempo gets very slow. Maybe the playing isn't concert hall caliber, but the difference is that she isn't a million miles away on some stage. She's right in front of you and smiling as though she's in heaven, which, she'll tell you, she is. Such is the appeal of the Reading Terminal pianists. What they do is unmediated. You're eavesdropping on an intimate musical experience normally heard only in a home or church. They aren't following trends. Why should they if there's no financial impetus to do so? They're just being who they are with no microphones, no worries about ticket sales, no artificial ingredients. Just music.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about the musicians of the Reading Terminal Market in tomorrow's paper. More than a century old, the Free Library of Philadelphia has grown from 3 rooms in City Hall to a network of 54 branches across the city, anchored by the Central Library off Logan Square. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the heart of Philadelphia's public library system.
At one end of Philadelphia's Benjamin Franklin Parkway, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, finished in 1928, perches like a Greek temple atop the hill. At the other end, off Logan Square, sits what could be the museum's smaller, if not younger, sibling, designed by some of the same people: African-American architect Julian Abel, who worked for Horace Trumbauer. The stately 1927 Beaux-Arts-style Central Library has tall columns, soaring windows, and statuary, suggesting a museum or palace, but one with an open door just a few steps up from the sidewalk.
Well, not only is it an architectural gem, you're sort of enticed to come in.
Siobhan Reardon is the president and director of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Its central library is home to popular fiction and nonfiction, movies, government publications, musical recordings, and the famed Fleischer collection of orchestral music. And that's just on the first floor.
The way the lobby is supposed to work is that you're immediately drawn to go upstairs and then explore the collection.
On the landing of a grand staircase beckons the figure of library founder Dr. William Pepper, who in 1891 donated a $225,000 bequest from his uncle to start up this free public library. Sandra Horrocks, Vice President of Communications and Development of the Library Foundation, which today raises money to enhance basic operations funded by the state and the city, says the concept of a free library filled a void.
The first libraries, and the library that was founded by Benjamin Franklin, was a subscription library. You had to pay a fee in order to be able to use the books and material. And Dr. Pepper thought that everybody should have equal access.
The collection started in the rooms in City Hall, moved to a concert hall on Chestnut Street, then to a space at 13th and Locust. Over the years, branches were added, including 17 funded with a $1.5 million grant from Andrew Carnegie in 1903. Library headquarters finally moved to the present location in 1927.
And when we opened, there were 1 million items in this building, which was astonishing. And now, of course, it has 7 million items.
The central library has upstairs rooms organized by themes: art, literature, education, philosophy and religion, social science and history. And that's not all.
We have a rare book department that has amazing collections of the work of Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe. We have the largest collection of work by Beatrix Potter outside of London.
There's a Bible collection, even writings on tablets.
Oh, medieval manuscripts. We have gorgeous, gorgeous medieval manuscripts. In addition, we have a collection of automobile material.
Outside of Detroit, we have the best collection, automotive collection, of any public library in the country.
Siobhan Reardon says in the future she wants more of these special collections on public view. Aside from books, the library has information encoded on new technology, DVDs, CDs, and computer stations with internet access, and help in navigating it all. There's a place to set up a business.
Entrepreneurs can come and do their business plan or doing a marketing plan.
Or look for a job.
You can set up an email account. You can get help in writing a resume. We will help you learn how to do online job searches, how to submit your resume. And then with that email account, you can get responses to your job applications.
Meanwhile, the branches tap into the pulse of their local communities, providing meeting space and literary resources. As an example, Reardon points to the Wyoming branch in the Northeast, which is surrounded by 4 schools.
And so not only are the classes coming in during the day, those children are coming into the library after school. The way the collections work is very tied to the community. So Vietnamese and Cambodian and Hindi and Chinese, and it's all very relevant to who's living in that community at this point in time.
Every branch has a children's section. Librarian Rachel Freed showed us to the Central Library's colorful rooms filled with fiction, nonfiction, picture books in different languages, computer stations, DVDs, graphic novels, and personalized help.
This is Mary, our after-school leader. She's here every day. Every single one of the branches has after-school homework help. You don't do tutoring, but if you come in with a problem, Mary will help you out.
That's great. Every subject?
Yes, and we can definitely handle up to 8th grade math.
And while libraries have long had a reputation as places to be quiet, this is not a hushed environment.
No, not at all. For the most part, the kids are encouraged to just be themselves. I mean, it's a library, not a vault or a catacomb.
Not a catacomb, but the walls of the central library are thick and not easy to adapt to modern technology or the need to serve an increasingly large community. Fundraising is now underway for a 130,000-square-foot addition, which will also open up new possibilities.
We want to be able to be a place where people can create content. And so that's why we're going to have self-publishing and a place for people to create music, make films. We want to have for teenagers this animation studio.
This new building is really going to be quite bright and quite open and much more a place for people.
Today, people often crowd the auditorium for talks by authors, many internationally known. Director of Author Events, Andy Cahan, says these occasions promote books, but also foster dialogue about important issues. The Middle East, the oil industry, presidential politics, and outer space. All have been subjects of books and author events.
Because we can deal with authors on any topic, anything you see in the paper is generally up for discussion here, with somebody who knows it inside and out to discuss it.
The success of these author events sparked the idea of a larger annual celebration of literacy and all the ways people get information today. Festival operations manager Sarah Goddard says Philadelphia is populated by literary consumers and creators who, along with outside organizations, participate in the festival's street fair.
Independent authors and writers groups, nonprofit organizations that have some kind of literary or educational mission. We do get a good turnout from our local publishers.
Special events, speaker series, and programs promoting computer literacy. Part of a new mission? Not really. Although libraries began with books, they were always about what books, and now new technologies, can do. They can inform, entertain, open up new worlds, and create connections among members of the community.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. While the car you drive to work or the mall may bear little resemblance to a souped-up, sleek machine that hurtles around a racetrack, its functional and aesthetic design likely owe a debt to the race car. Showcasing dozens of prize cars from one collector, the Simeone Foundation Museum in Philadelphia examines how competition inspired much innovation in the auto industry. And as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the museum also demonstrates the artistry involved to design and build these useful and at times very beautiful machines.
Whether or not you consider yourself a gearhead, cars have a way of stirring up emotions. Perhaps you fondly recall the simplicity of a car a parent owned, or become nostalgic over reminders of your own first set of wheels. While sentimental bonds to automobiles are common, Fred Simeone takes affection for cars to a whole other level. Over his lifetime, the retired neurosurgeon has gathered over 60 cars.
I guess the collection really started based on my relationship with my dad, who was also a general practitioner but worked his way through medical school fixing cars. So by the time I was 9, 10 years old, we were doing cars.
A Philadelphia native, Simeone says he and his father would spend hours poring over car magazines, going to races and visiting junkyards, finding vintage cars to fix up and tinker with together.
So I had a little bit of a head start in terms of knowing what's good and what had a potential to be great.
Beginning with 4 cars he inherited from his father, Simeone built the bulk of his automobile collection over 4 decades, acquiring Bentleys, Mercedes, BMWs, Alfa Romeos, Jaguars, and Ferraris, many of them bought or swapped for at a time when the cars were much easier and cheaper to obtain. At the outset, Simeone didn't have strict criteria for the kind of cars he collected, but he eventually came to recognize a common trait.
Winning competition cars was the theme of the collection, even though I didn't articulate it until later on. Great sports racing cars were not numerous when they were made, and nowadays there's a lot of people who want them. But in those days, I could not only get a competition car, but one that was a winner.
Today, few individual collectors can rival the scope and value of Simeone's car collection, which is in many ways, he says, the result of a lot of luck, similar to the fortunes of another Philadelphia collector, Dr. Albert Barnes of the Barnes Foundation.
Who got into French Impressionist painting a little bit ahead of the curve, and he was able to accumulate a collection which would be impossible to duplicate now.
The cars that Simeone has accumulated are today housed in a former engine manufacturing plant in South Philadelphia, forming the Simeone Foundation Museum. This nonprofit was created about a year ago as a way to keep Simeone's entire collection together for years to come, open to the public. About 2/3 of the cars are still in running condition. Once a month, the foundation holds a demonstration day, when 2 or 3 of the vintage machines are pushed out, started up, and driven around the back parking lot. Kevin Kelly is the Simeone Museum's curator, which in the car museum world means he's essentially in charge of maintaining the cars. When I visited, Kelly was preparing a 1913 Mercer Raceabout with its wooden wheel rims, two bucket leather seats, and no side doors for a demonstration day. He offered to take me for a spin.
Just hop on the chair.
All right. Good.
That's the starter. That engaged slowly.
With numerous vehicles in the collection nearly a century old, Kelly keeps busy ensuring that the cars remain in working condition. Indeed, they don't always start right away, but he eventually got the Mercer running. The fact that a race car built in the early 1900s can still impressively speed around a paved track, adeptly handling tight corners, says something about the craftsmanship of these cars. It's one reason Kevin Kelly finds them so compelling.
This kind of stuff, this pre-war stuff, it's workmanship that's built into them. All nice materials, brass and aluminum and wood and leather and everything you can do with your hands and with your mind working together. That's what I find appealing about them. And I think if you talk to anybody that's fooling around with these old cars, they're going to have that same kind of feeling about them. That's the way they love them.
Inside the museum, cars are displayed to tell the stories of how the vehicles competed in their time. Enormous dioramas painted by Philadelphia muralists serve as backdrops, depicting the famous race courses and circuits where many of the cars actually competed. Watkins Glen in New York, Italy's Mille Miglia, the Bonneville Salt Flats, and France's Le Mans. Showcasing race cars built from 1909 to 1975, the exhibition demonstrates how car technology evolved in the 20th century, often spurred on by the desire to be more competitive in races. Cars became safer, sleeker, smoother, and more efficient. Tires went from being tall and skinny to short and wide. Aerodynamics progressed. Fuel injection was introduced, and brake technology drastically improved. One hallmark of the Simeone collection is that the vehicles closely resemble the production cars that an average consumer could have acquired. The Simeone Foundation's Harry Hurst describes them all as racing sports cars.
And by that I mean they're cars with headlights and fenders that could conceivably be driven on the road. And so what we try to concentrate strictly on racing sports cars. We don't have Indianapolis cars, open wheel cars, Formula One cars, things like that, because those are so far removed from the production automobile that you or I would drive.
Hurst says this guiding principle means that the museum's main exhibition doesn't include cars built after the mid-1970s. After that, racing became so competitive and commercial that the cars no longer resembled any production models. For Fred Simeone, the appeal of racing cars prior to the 70s extends far beyond their use in competitions, horsepower, and engine size.
There is a pure artistic aspect to these cars.
Whether it's the 1909 American underslung car with its slender white tires, the fire engine red bullet shape of the 1938 Alfa Romeo, or the smooth silver fender lines of the 1953 Jaguar, it's clear that a great deal of creativity went into the design of the machines.
The best analogy that I can give you is furniture. We all know that furniture is a practical thing, but it's also beautiful. And it goes from Empire to Victorian to modern furniture, but in every instance, it's a utilitarian object made to be beautiful. Well, so is the automobile. And I think in many ways deserves the same respect that fine furniture does. We try to portray that.
Portraying the beauty, sophistication, and evolution of engineering that continues to capture the imagination of generations young and old. While the average person doesn't fully understand how an automobile works, they are compelling contraptions. And the Simeone Museum cars remind us that we're not always just interested in getting from point A to point B. Whether we're racing or going to the grocery store, we have a long history of wanting to travel in style.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Simeone Foundation Museum in South Philadelphia is open year-round. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.